Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. We're going to give you the latest of why you should be concerned about drinking water from plastic anything. Also, those energy drinks that are so popular, they alter heart function in a bad way. Also, we're going to look at sex may be one of the secrets to a long life and good health. We'll tell you about that. Blocking antioxidants in cancer cells reduce tumor growth in mice. Well, which are these blocking antioxidants? I'll give you the which ones can help. And also, a study of young parents highlights the links among stress, poverty, and ethnicity. And also, we'll be talking about the vitamin D in women can reduce pain, depression, and diabetes, Malaya University. We have a lot more also, always from peer-reviewed literature. My guest in the second part of our program today will be Dr. Michael Schumann. We're going to talk about breaking away from the Wall Street investment trap and creating a resilient community and personal life in the local community economy model. So that'll be interesting, something very positive, especially for people who didn't know where to put their money, what are the best or better investments. From our public health segment today, an 8-year study finds the flu vaccines ineffective in decreasing hospitalizations from the flu. That leads us into our call to action today. Then why in the world, if all the evidence points to the flu vaccine being worthless and dangerous, why is this Mayor Bloomberg, in the last few days in office, trying to ram through a proposal that would make annual flu shots and the pneumococcal, a Prevnar, shot mandatory for children to attend preschool or daycare in New York City? So we will give you the latest on that as well. What is the latest of the real science on GMOs? How about deformities, sickness, and livestock deaths? We'll talk about that. Then a commentary on the war on democracy, how corporations and spy agencies use the notion of security to defend profiteering and to crush all activism. Nefez Ahmed from The Guardian. And Obama's ludicrous Afghanistan declarations from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Reports. From the environmental segment, a new study finds higher methane emissions from fracking, and separately, the entire Arab world sinks deeper into a water crisis, and that's according to a major new study. Why is anyone talking about that? We will. Let's begin. First up, most people drink their liquids from plastic. They should be drinking from either stainless steel or glass, that would be fine. Here's the reason why you should not be drinking anything from plastic. This is from The Real Agenda, a major study in the peer-reviewed journal Toxicological Sciences. It was done with a group of individuals, and here's what they found. Quote, drinking water from plastic cups or bottles could be giving a lot of people, millions of people, headaches. New research shows that a controversial gender bender chemical in synthetic packaging may trigger migraines. Biphenyl A, which is also known as BPA, has already been linked to a range of health problems, including obesity, infertility, and heart attacks. Now, the latest study shows that it can also affect debilitating headaches. So, quote, a previously performed study using fresh foods dietary intervention demonstrated a significant decrease in urinary BPAs, 66% reduction in patients after just 3 days. These findings, combined with our results, suggest that a clinical trial to decrease BPA exposure and levels of migraine sufferers may reduce headache frequency or severity, revealing strategies that may increase the quality of life of migrainers. This was done at the University of Kansas. In lay language, what this is saying is this. A lot of people have migraines, and don't realize that it could have come from the chemicals, specifically the biphenyl A, that are in virtually almost all plastic. And a lot of people try to be health conscious and are drinking bottled water, or maybe even filtering water at home and taking it to work with them. But that could be causing that. Now, the good part of this study is what I just quoted. By getting on a cleansing program in a very short period of time, you can eliminate a lot of this biphenyl from your body, and hence you'll clean up the whole area of chemical toxicity, specifically the biphenyl, and reduce migraines. You've all seen, I'm sure, the ads for the energy drinks. This is from the University of Bonn in Germany. Quote, energy drinks have become a multi-billion dollar industry that continues to grow, yet regulation of this enterprise remains largely unchecked. Now, a new study shows that healthy adults who consume energy drinks, quote, have an increased risk of heart contraction rates an hour later. That's serious. This was presented at the annual meeting of Radiological Society of North America. The study's authors, including Dr. Jonas Dorner, note that although the largest consumers of energy drinks have traditionally been teens and young adults, people of all demographics have begun to consume such drinks in recent years. Quote, until now, we haven't known exactly what effect these energy drinks have on the function of the heart. Well, now they do. Usually energy drinks contain caffeine as their main pharmaceutical ingredient. The amount of caffeine is up to 3 times higher than in any other caffeinated beverages like coffee or cola. He adds that side effects associated with consuming large amounts of caffeine, including rapid heartbeat, palpitations, rise in blood pressure, and even seizures or death. Energy drinks prompted increased strain in left ventricle. So, not good. You don't want to end up having a heart attack because you have an energy drink, and it can happen in about an hour afterwards. Quote, results show that compared with images taken before participants consumed the energy drinks, the post-beverages MRIs showed they had increased peak strain and peak systolic strain rates in the heart's left ventricle. That's not good. So you could have an energy drink and an hour later have a heart attack and die. That's what it says. That's what it means. Now, we publish an awful lot of original articles, more than any other journalist that I'm aware of, on radio in American history. Over 671 I've published to date. The latest is just this week. In fact, I have 3 this week alone. Later this week will be a very powerful article that will be posted on my Facebook as well as on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. It's called The Hidden Hand. I have taken my one-hour version I did as an on-air original commentary last week, and I have increased it, shortened it, and it'll be an article. It'll go out, and you can read it. Also, one on fluoride and the latest science behind accusing fluoride of being a very dangerous chemical we should have in no quantity added to our water supply or toothpaste or mouthwashes. And the third is on the subject of caffeine. And I'm going to do an updated current version showing you all the problems that you have with caffeine in the diet, especially in the amounts people are consuming them today, very high amounts, and what this does to our health. And so you have 3 new articles that will be up as of this week, and that will help a lot of people. Sex may be one of the secrets to good health, youth, and long life. This is from UPI. Quote, males that expect sex and don't get it experience serious health consequences and age faster. So says a senior author, Scott Pletcher, professor at the University of Michigan Medical School and researcher in this particular area. And they're looking at a laboratory model for this. Quote, our findings give us better understanding of about how sensory perception and physiological states are integrated in the brain to affect long-term health and lifespan. Well, I don't believe that we need any laboratory experiments to figure this one out. Having a healthy, happy, exciting, creative, stimulating, passionate sex life is good for everyone, every consenting adult. And yet, for all the wrong reasons, as a society, so many people have chosen to avoid, deny, or intentionally dismiss this as being relevant to their well-being. And on various programs, we've gone into great depth about the chemical that's secreted in men and women when they're sexually aroused or when they find sexual fulfillment with their partner, and how that reduces stress, reduces cortisol, which is a major stress hormone, and epinephrine, brings down your blood sugar level, which is great for diabetics, helps people who would otherwise not get a good night's sleep because it increases endorphins, so you have that feel-good sensation long after your sexual experience. And we allow a whole lot to interfere between a healthy, vigorous, passionate sex life and what could be happening to allow us a longer life. Now, when I travel around the world and I'm visiting cultures, indigenous cultures, native cultures, city, suburban, rural environments, I ask them, of all the things in your life that allow you happiness, contentment, longevity, tell me what you believe is allowing that to happen. And in the top five is always sex. Number one is always the quality of a person's family life. I don't care where I'm at. I don't care what country. I don't care if I'm in the city, the suburbs, or the rural environment. It's always the same feedback. Not so in the United States, because we, for the most part, we don't really have healthy interfamily dynamics where a lot is shared together, as it once was in our society. We have families in the United States, but ask the average soccer mom, how much quality time do you have to spend on things that are important to you? You spend with your family together, you spend with your partner. And they just look at you and laugh, saying, what world are you living in? You kidding? You know, here's my to-do list. And they show you about 40 things. They've got to take this person here. So you're really a chauffeur, and you are you're a cook, you're an innkeeper, but you can't be a disciplinarian, and you can't demand that people actually pay attention to you at any point, or can't sit and have a meal together with no cell phones, no distractions, just the power of a person's energy at a table. Yeah, and we adapt to that. So needless to say, people in the United States are looking for ways to supplement what they're missing at the essential core level, the primal level. And sex is a primal energy. And we deny it. We put everything else in its place. Other societies, they don't. So they say right at the top, the stronger the family bonds, the more quality time we spend together within our family, the better we feel about ourselves. And that's especially true of older people, because the older you get in other societies, the more important you become to the family, to the village, to the community. You're revered. You become the wise man and woman, and your company is constantly sought, your advice constantly required, your understanding of issues. So imagine that you never become irrelevant or forgotten, but always desired because of your uniqueness. And then the pace of life is important. I found this is true in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica, in the rainforest, in Venezuela, Brazil, wherever I've been. The pace of your work, the pace of your living. And you really see this when you go to eat with a family. They invite you in, And there's a great sense of hospitality. And then you see that the Americans always are finished, every dish, quick. And these people just kind of look at you and are amused at it because they take their time. So taking time to enjoy life is in the top five. Doing things that impassion you, things that you love to do. When I was visiting in Italy, we spent the day on the Italian Riviera with an older family, a family who could trace back over 500 years, their family living in the same area. In fact, I was in a barn that was 700 years old. Imagine that. A barn that's twice as old as America, or at least what we now know as colonized America, from the 1600s. And the man every day would go for this walk down to the water's edge and cast his line down. Whether he caught anything or not was irrelevant. This was his time to allow his mind to combine with the sea and just to be present with nature. And his father had done it before him and his grandfather before him. And this is what they enjoy doing. So quality time, and how often do we give ourselves quality time? We're constantly searching for extra time to do anything, and then almost always, because of multitasking, give too little time to the things that are important or the people that are important. And then having wonderful relationships, harmonized energy that flows effortlessly, just dancing with delight, the energy between people. And then a vital, passionate sex life. Those are the top five from my research around the world. And none of those top five would make it into the average American's top five. Blocking antioxidants in cancer cells reduce tumor growth in mice. This is from the Peer Review Journal of Clinical Investigation. And here's what it says. A little scientific, but I'll break it into lay language. This was done at Northwestern University. Cancers have adapted to cope with high levels of immune system-producing free radicals, also referred to as reactive oxygen species, by overproducing antioxidant proteins. One of these proteins, superoxide dismutase, is overproduced in lung adenocarcinomas and has been implicated as a target for chemotherapy. Well, in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, a group of scientists from Northwestern University report the effects of superoxide dismutase pharmacological inhibitor on non-small cell lung cancer with positive results. So in lay language, what did I just say? I'll make it real simple. For decades, the woman who led the natural hygiene detox movement in America and deserves the credit for it, it was after Herbert Shelton, it was Ann Wigmore. Now, a lot of people have used her name or institute, but they can't begin to touch what she did. I knew Ann Wigmore, and she saved a lot of lives, thousands of lives. And what was the basis of her therapy? Wheatgrass juice. And what's in wheatgrass juice? Well, superoxide dismutase. And superoxide dismutase and chlorophyll together are one of the best ways in the world of blocking cancers in the body. So when people would go to her center and drink wheatgrass juice all day long, there wasn't anything aesthetically pleasing about it. They were just bare bones. I mean, it was just a Spartan environment, non-aesthetic. There wasn't great lectures, there wasn't great classes, and that's okay because people weren't looking for that. They were just looking to cleanse, detox, rebuild. And that she did at a 10-plus level. So here they're discovering something that a whole movement had known. They didn't know the chemistry. They simply knew cause and effect. And Bernard Jensen was a natural hygienist. I remember visiting him. I was doing a lecture in Los Angeles. And the lecture went way late, and I missed my plane back to New York. And in the audience was a person who said, well, I was just at Bernard Jensen, and he he speaks very highly of you and says, you know, that his whole generation are leaving us, and you're the new young voice. And he says, have I ever met him? I said, no, I've never met Bernard Jensen. I've read his books. I have a lot of respect for his work. So I took a ride to his place. It was very beautiful, bucolic, at least as bucolic as California can be. It's not my favorite state aesthetically. I just think it looked like one big brown bunch of little molehills, the whole clear until you get up to the north and part of the state. Then it's magnificent with the large forest for the rest of it. Forget about it. Just, man, how they make something that doesn't look like anything and make it look great, like the meatpacking district. Let's go down to, this is the new hip area to live in Manhattan. Yeah, they're going to only charge us, you know, $1,000 a square foot and for $1 million for a little apartment. And it's a dump. The whole area is a dump. Yeah, but now don't say that. You see, if enough hip people get together, then suddenly we become the place where everyone wants to go. Everybody wants to go there? Why? You mean you got some... And sure enough, in time, like the meat district, they'll take a dumpy area and make it look less dumpy, but it's still dumpy. It's like Soho. You think with all the money that comes out of Soho, someone will go actually there and fix the streets or the sidewalks. You know, you can't walk on the sidewalk. You can't drive up the street because it's all broken and patched and crappy. And yet every single one of those buildings, every single one, the apartments, 5,000 square foot lofts, start at like $2 to $5 million. All that wealth and nobody wants to clean up the environment. But that's typical. That's a lot of that's like California. In any case, here was this man who had his own orchards and was very proud of these, you know, the orchards because he has a climate to grow almost year round. Very vigorous. Remember looking, he had blue eyes and very white eyes, and he was smiling, had a vigorous handshake. And there he was, his wheatgrass juice every day and his green apples and celery and cucumber. And he was the last of the real healthy natural hygienist who worked with people and taught people how to cleanse and rebalance. Now, if you look at what these individuals were doing in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, some made it into the 70s, all that is being verified by modern science today. They were just helping a whole lot of people before then. I remember meeting Gaylord Houser, very distinguished man, that wonderful sense of humor. And he was the dapper gentleman of Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s. And he was the personal nutritionist at that time for some of the leading people in Hollywood, including Gloria Swanson. And if you looked at the advice he was giving then, you're talking about, you know, 80 years ago. It's as valid today. They didn't have all the vitamins. They had a few vitamins, but they didn't have very many vitamins. But they were juicing. They were doing enemas, colonics. They were exercising. They were doing stretching. They were doing different forms of mind relaxation techniques. So we think we're really hip today. Well, take a look in history and you'll see that we had a lot of people who made it possible for us to share what we do today. And finally, from the University of California, we are living under an avalanche of chronic stress, driven by concerns ranging from parenting to discrimination, disproportionately affecting poor mothers and fathers. According to the first results from a comprehensive multi-state study, quote, those who are poor have much higher stress than those who are not. In fact, being poor was associated with more of almost everything that's stressful, said Professor of Psychology, UCLA College of Letters and Sciences. The report found that although people with higher incomes had lower levels of stress overall, stress levels aren't reduced as much for higher income African Americans as they are for higher income whites. Researchers also learned that Latinos, especially recent migrants, tend to have lower levels of stress than other groups. The research, funded by the National Institutes of Health, Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center, is based on extensive interviews with over 2,400 mothers who had given birth within the previous month, and 1,383 partners were fathers. and to talk about how you're dealing with stress, what kind of stress is chronic, and how does it impact you? Well, more often than not, stress will impact you on every level. It prematurely ages you. It increases your biological aging. It hurts your heart, hurts your immune system, hurts your neuroendocrine system, raises your blood pressure, increases your fat, increases your cortisol level. That's what stress does. So wouldn't you think at this point, knowing that at least 260, 70 million Americans living in chronic stress, that we would have an anti-stress program sponsored by the federal government or the Surgeon General and show all the good ways that we can reduce stress? Well, we could start a national power walking program. You could do it in every city in the United States. You could do it in malls early in the morning for people who want to do it in a safe and environmentally controlled area. You could have yoga classes. You could have deep breathing classes. These are not expensive to teach, not expensive to learn. You could talk about how just an hour of exercise a day controls your stress level for the next 6 hours. So let's just say that you were to do 45 minutes of power walking in the morning and 45 minutes in the early evening after work. Well, you've just controlled your stress levels by replacing high levels of cortisol with endorphins, the feel-good emotions, for 12 hours or half your day. Well, you would also be reducing weight. You would then reduce the incidence of heart attack, diabetes, and stroke and depression. You would save a million lives a year. You don't have to have enormous bureaucracy and all kinds of hassle to get people healthy. From our environmental segment today, we know that we have at least one half of all counties in the United States are in permanent drought. The average person does not know this, probably doesn't care. As long as you turn on a tap and water comes out, that's all you care about. But what no one's looking at is what happens when gas hydrofracking comes and uses more water than a whole community. And where does it go? And how's it being replenished? And then you see farms. Drive with me on one of my trips. Drive through as I drive through Colorado and New Mexico, Nevada, up through Wyoming into Montana, over across the Dakotas, and take a look at how many farms are abandoned. They can't even be sold. And you stop and talk with people and you say, what happened here? I see that there's about 200 miles. I see nothing but signs, closed for sale. And one guy says, well, it's this way. We've been farming this property here for over 150 years, cattle. And then the wells started going, and we had to dig deeper wells until finally we didn't have enough money to dig a well deep enough, 12,000 to 15,000 feet, that's a $50,000 well, to get the water. So we just had to let it go. No one else is going to buy the property if you don't have water on it. Didn't you know that you're running out of water? Didn't you ever ask? Because there are very detailed charts that show you your aquifer levels. No, we didn't get around to that. I guess, you know, we took it for granted. You know, you'd always had water, would always have water. And that's what's happening all across the United States. It's worse in the entire Arab world. This is from the United Nations. Quote, the Arab world is widely perceived as blessed with an embarrassment of riches and abundance of oil. Saudi Arabia, not the smartest group of people in the world, the Arab family, are they, the Saudi family? Let's see. They're blessed with riches. Decency towards women obviously was not one of them. And I can't stand the Arab family, the Saud family. What racist, what warmongering, what hate-mongering, what misogynist individuals they are. Besides that, they have one of the highest per capita incomes, as Qatar. They also treat their women the same. And home to the world's tallest luxury building. United Arab Emirates. How'd they build that building? Well, slave labor. We won't talk about that. But it lacks one of the most infinite or finite resources necessary for human survival, water. Quote, the average Arab citizen has 8 times less access to renewable water than the average global citizen, and more than 2/3 of surface water resources originate from outside the region. There's a report, it's called Water Governance in the Arab Region, Managing Scarcity and Securing the Future. Well, there is no future. You've got an awful lot of people living where you have too little water, and then what little water you have is being drained. You want to see something interesting? Show you how stupid things can be. In one of the major cities, what is considered architecturally the most beautiful city in the world, and indeed there are beautiful buildings there, Dubai, they don't have any septic fields. And as a result, what you don't see, but you can sure smell, is every morning miles upon miles upon miles of thousands of trucks that take the raw sewage out of these luxury buildings. The most beautiful buildings in the world don't have a toilet access. So as a result, they pump them out of these tanks and then drive out into the middle of the desert to dispose of this stuff. I saw a photograph of that lasted 8 miles, 8 nonstop miles of trucks. Could you imagine that? And yet, that's all built at sea level, and the sea is rising. And they don't have a place to put their human excrement, but they have the money to truck it out. Boy, that's one of those strange phenomena. So the Arab world, you're running out of water. And then let's see what they do. What will be their plan B when they have all that wealth? They can't grow anything. So if you can't feed your population with what you can grow and you can't give them water, then how are you going to bring water into your major mega cities? Well, you've only got a couple of choices. The most obvious choice is you're going to have to go into Africa or South America and lease or buy huge tracts of land that is arable. And you wouldn't be able to, you would even go broke trying to tank in on tankers all of the water that you would need. Talk about not looking at the reality. They're way past peak soil, peak water. They have all that money building all those cities in a place that is not going to be there in the future. Now, you don't want to be around a gas hydrofracking well for any reason. This is more one more reason why. This is from Nick Cunningham from Oil Price. Quote, a major new study finds that methane emissions from the production of shale gas may be, in fact, higher than previously thought. The studies published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, the current issue, cast into doubt the notion that natural gas produces half as much greenhouse gas pollution as coal. Natural gas has been embraced by many, including President Obama, as a centerpiece of America's climate change plan. Methane can be released from natural gas wells during the drilling process. Scientists have thus far had difficulty measuring these methane emissions precisely, with competing studies stirring controversy. The latest report, published by a group of 15 scientists, found that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is significantly understating the amount of methane released during natural gas production. Specifically, the report concludes that methane emissions could be 50% higher than EPA estimates. Well, the findings could put pressure on state environmental regulators as well as on the U.S. EPA to draw up new regulations. And that's what I hope happens. One more thing we can do to protect the environment. Now our call to action. This is the latest study, and I'll report it. It's from the Marshfield Clinic Research Foundation in Marshfield, Wisconsin. They looked at hospitalizations during the flu season, covering an 8-year time frame. The study looked at patients over the age of 20 with laboratory-confirmed influenza. Now, the results of their 8-year study, quote, vaccination was not associated with a reduced risk of hospital admission among all participants in with influenza, end quote. So, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy in the Academic Health Center, University of Minnesota, the influenza vaccine did not reduce the risk of hospitalization for flu after vaccine failure. And so that's that. So no longer can they say we should be vaccinating people because it helps prevent them from having to go to the hospital. It does not. Here's our call to action for today. Right now, we are asking for people to demonstrate next Tuesday in front of City Hall, New York City, and to protest the attempt by Mayor Michael Bloomberg in his latest few days in office to ram through a proposal that would make annual flu shots and pneumococcal, what is called Prevnar, shot mandatory for children to attend preschool or daycare in New York City. Now, these children be the only citizens in the state of New York to get a flu shot. They'd be required to get a flu shot. And the New York City Board of Health will consider this policy at a meeting on December 11th. And they will probably rubber stamp whatever Bloomberg wants. That's how they function. So according to John Gilmore, Executive Director of Autism Action Network, we should all show up. I'm not in, so I can't, or I would be there. And it's at 11 a.m. Gather at the New York City Hall at the Manhattan end of the Brooklyn Bridge at 11 a.m. There'll be a press conference at noon. So let's fight back on this if you don't want to see these children have to take a flu shot that is worthless and dangerous. In a few moments, my guest. Now, a few commentaries. The first is from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Radio. It's short, but I think it says what a lot of the mainstream media did not have the courage to say. It is entitled Obama's Ludicrous Afghanistan Declarations. Quote, the most ridiculous actor in the fictitious U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is not President Hamid Karzai, the hustler the U.S. installed as its puppet after the American invasion of 2001. The real clowns in this charade are those Americans that pretend to believe President Obama when he says the U.S. war in Afghanistan will end on the last day of next year. Obama is, of course, lying through his teeth. The United States and its NATO allies plan to keep 10 to 16,000 troops in the country, occupying 9 bases, some of them set aside for exclusive American use, and would remain there at least 10 years, through 2024. Shamelessly, Obama claims these troops, including thousands from the Special Operations Killer Elite, will have, quote, no combat role. It's the same lie President Kennedy told in 1963 when he called the 16,000 U.S. troops then stationed in Vietnam advisors, and the same bold-faced deception that Obama himself tried to pull off unsuccessfully in Iraq until the Iraqis kicked the Americans out. Barack Obama has aggregated to himself the right to redefine the very meaning of war, having 2 years ago declared that the 7-month U.S. bombing campaign against Libya was not really a war because no Americans were killed. In Afghanistan, Obama waves his semantic magic wand to transform the past 12 years of war into 10 more years of not war, simply by changing the nomenclature. This is hucksterism from hell. There is zero chance of a zero option. If there was a devil, he would be laughing his butt off at Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor and raving banshee of war, whose assignment is to pretend that the U.S. might choose the so-called zero option if President Karzai doesn't immediately sign away his country to the Americans for the next 10 years. By zero option, Washington means it might just pick up its killer soldiers and weapons and leave Afghanistan, but that's an empty bluff, since when has the U.S. voluntarily left any place it has forcibly occupied? There is zero chance of a zero option. But I'm reminded of the events of 1963 Vietnam, when the Vietnamese president, Diem, and his brother were overthrown and executed in a U.S.-backed coup, sending the homicidal Susan Rice to get in President Karzai's face is definitely some kind of threat. Far from ending U.S. imperial wars, Barack Obama has expanded the theaters of armed conflict. He tried to keep U.S. troops in Iraq, but the Iraqis insisted on the withdrawal terms and timetable they had negotiated with President George Bush. Iraq is now paying a heavy price as the U.S. and its allies arm Iraqis, al-Qaeda, and other jihadist elements fighting to overthrow the government of neighboring Syria. These U.S.-backed jihadists, the same ones the Americans fought against in Iraq for 8 years, now wage war against Shiites on both sides of the border. If there's any hope for an eventual peace in the region, it is that Washington might finally begin to understand that it can no longer control events through brute force or by using jihadists as surrogates in the Middle East and South Asia. Maybe that's why the Americans have tried to strike a deal with Iran. Maybe President Karzai thinks the winds of change will be sweeping through his neighborhood soon, and he doesn't want to go out like the puppet he came in. End quote. And finally, from our public health segment, a special report on deformity, sickness, and livestock deaths, the real cost of GM animal feed, by Andrew Aisley of The Economist. And I'll just do the first page of this. Quote, much of our meat and dairy produce is made from animals raised on GM foods. Alarming new claims suggest that the genetically modified diet is affecting animal health, promoting fears over human safety. At first glance, the frozen bundles could be mistaken for conventional joints of meat. But as a man named Pedersen, a Danish pig farmer, lifts them carefully out of the freezer, it becomes apparent they are in fact whole piglets, some horribly deformed, with gross or other abnormalities, others stunted. This is the result, Pedersen claims, of feeding the animals a diet containing genetically modified ingredients. Or more specifically, he believes, feed made from GM soya and sprayed with the controversial herbicide glyphosate. Pedersen, who produces 13,000 pigs a year and supplies Europe's largest pork company, Danish Crown, says he became so alarmed at the apparent levels of deformity, sickness, and deaths, and poor productivity he was witnessing in his animals that he decided to experiment by changing their diet from GM to non-GM feed. The results, he said, were remarkable. Quote, using genetically modified feed, I saw symptoms of bloat, stomach ulcers, high rates of diarrhea, pigs born with deformities, but when I switched to non-GM feed, these problems went away, some within a matter of days. The farmer says that not only has the switch in diet improved the visible health of the pigs, it has made the farm more profitable with less medicine use and higher productivity. Quote, less abortions, more piglets born in each litter, and breeding animals living longer. He also maintains that man hours have been reduced with less cleaning needed and fewer complications to the animals. Inside the farmhouse, piles of paperwork are laid out across a vast table. Printouts, reports, statistics, scientific research, correspondence. Pedersen shows me photos, he says, are of animals adversely affected by the GM feed. There's more piglets with spinal deformities, their back legs dragging on the ground. Others have visible problems with their faces, limbs or tails. There's even a Siamese twin, two animals joined at the head. Pedersen believes these abnormalities and other problems were caused, at least in part, by the presence of the herbicide glyphosate in his GM pig feed. Glyphosate is routinely sprayed on many soy and cereal crops to kill weeds and maximize yields. Although it is used on conventional crops, its usage on GM soya and maize is particularly prevalent as the crops are engineered to be resistant to the chemical, killing the weeds but leaving the crop plants unaffected. And the introduction of GM crops resistant to glyphosate allowed crops to be sprayed with the herbicide to control weeds, often many times over a growing season without killing the crops. But this all also led to much higher levels of glyphosate in the plants and the seeds. And he goes on for about six pages to describe how all the politicians in Europe are trying to say no, GMO foods are good, and he's just one farmer showing no, they're not. And what does it mean when you have a diseased animal and you eat the diseased animals? Where is the science in genomic science to show that your cells will not pick up those defective genes, those diseases? We do not have that science to protect us. I'm Gary Noll, and that's the latest from our public health segment. We're going to go to our guest now and to talk about something that needs a lot of discussion, and that is breaking away from Wall Street investment traps and creating a resistant community and personal life in the local community economy models. Let me mention before we go there that tomorrow's program, I'm going to have an exclusive interview with the gentleman whose life is the focus of a new Christmas Day film with Leonardo DiCaprio leading the role and directed by Martin Scorsese. It's The Wolf of Wall Street. In his only filmed interview, which was to be a part of my Greed Street documentary on Wall Street and the people behind the scenes and the culture. When I filmed him, I didn't know that he was going to be doing this film, so we went ahead and edited it, and it's 23 minutes. That'll be on tomorrow's show. You won't want to miss that. Let's now say hello to Michael Schumann. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
Nice to be with you.
I'd given your background and your resume earlier on our program, including your latest book, Local Dollars. Begin by first outlining for us, if you would please, how our economy today and investments in our IRAs and pensions and educational funds systematically invest in Wall Street, empowers them, and then share with us the reasons why the average American doesn't realize this. And what, in your estimation, are the biggest illusions sold to us by Wall Street?
Well, there's a lot to say on every phrase in that question, and let me begin by just pointing to something that your viewers, your listeners have been paying attention to the last couple of years, and that's the Move Your Money campaign to try to move money out of big banks like Bank of America and into local banks and credit unions. And, you know, this has been a remarkably successful movement, arguably at least, hundreds of billions of dollars have moved from one institution to another. And yet, even if this movement was 100% successful, it would barely make a dent in the overall structure of U.S. finance, because banking is a relatively small piece of the U.S. financial picture. At least four times larger is this animal we call securities. And securities are all about long-term investment. Long-term investments are stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance funds. And they total about $30 trillion. If you look carefully at those, what you see, and it's rather stunning, is that these funds are 100% invested in Fortune 500 big companies, publicly traded companies. And what is outrageous about that is that publicly traded companies like these are the minority of the U.S. economy. That is, that roughly half, arguably more if you count home-based business, of the economy is small local business or medium-scale local business. These businesses are more profitable than Fortune 500 companies. They are at least as competitive, and yet these businesses are systematically being denied our investment. And the reason is that we have securities laws that were enacted in the early 1900s for very progressive reasons, which was to protect the uninformed investor from buying, swampland in Florida. And I certainly sympathize with that objective. But the kinds of rules that were enacted have effectively created and preserved a Wall Street monopoly on our long-term capital. And so the local investment movement is all about tearing down those walls and rethinking how we organize our investments so that we put more of our money in local businesses that are more linked to community well-being, to jobs, and to prosperity in our communities.
Can you give us specific examples, please?
Well, a specific example of local investment, you mean?
Yes.
So really, there are any, if your viewers and listeners go on to any one of hundreds of websites, whether it is Prosper, Kiva, the Lending Club, there are these donation sites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and you will see businesses that are absolutely desperate for capital with great ideas. People are figuring out small ways to get money into their hands. But Kickstarter and Indiegogo are all about donations. You don't really invest. You can't get a rate of return there. And some of these larger peer-to-peer lending sites like Prosper and the Lending Club have not really opened themselves up very far to small business yet, but a little bit. So we need another generation of these kinds of sites to tap into local businesses and allow the average investor to put money in the form of loans, in the form of equity investment, buying stock from small businesses, or in the form of royalty agreements.
All right. You are a member of the Post-Carbon Institute, headed by Richard Heimberg, who has been a guest on this program in the past. When we look at the threats of reaching peak oil, and now the likely peak everything, climate change, increase in natural disasters, peak water, peak soil, how will the Wall Street investment economy fare compared to investing in local community economies and alternative investments outside the Wall Street influence?
Well, I think the Wall Street economy is in big trouble. And really, you can start to see the ways in which the Wall Street economy was falling apart in 2008. And if we did not come to its rescue and heroically bail it out with, you know, $750 billion, much of the big banking sector would have collapsed. My belief is that we have to be prepared, and in fact, we have to be enthusiastic about inefficient large companies failing and helping small businesses step into their wake. And I believe right now, I mean, if you look at it, as I said earlier, about half the economy is rooted in small local business, half in larger companies. I think that as these realities of rising energy prices and rising problems of climate change begin to kick in, we will see those numbers move to about 80% of our economy is going to be locally rooted, and only very small pieces will be the things that we rely on from outside of our community boundaries.
We hear constantly that investing in the Wall Street system promises higher rates of return, and this, of course, is what the majority of investors seek. Wall Street claims it has a 5% long-term performance record with existing markets. And therefore, the idea of investing at the local level doesn't seem to promise the same kind of return rates possible as investing in Wall Street. First, is this true or just a myth? And would you address the kind of short and long-term return rate people could expect by investing in their local economies and small businesses?
So I would first say that the numbers that you're reciting are, if you look at the full spectrum of the kind of representations you get from Wall Street, a 5% annual rate of return would be on the lower side. If you listen to AM radio people like Rick Edelman, they will tell you that if you leave your money in Wall Street 10, 20, 30 years, you will get something like 8 or 12, or sometimes they'll even say 20% per year rate of return. And these numbers are all made up and fraudulent. Even the 5% number is really hard to justify. The winner of this year's Nobel Prize was a fellow named Robert Shiller. He's an economist at Yale. He is responsible for what's called the Case-Shiller Index that follows housing prices. But if you go to his website, he has the most comprehensive listing of the prices year, actually month by month, since 1879 of what the S&P initially 100, then it became 500, was on Wall Street. So it's a really good picture of Wall Street. And if you look in any 12-month period since 1879 and dutifully take out inflation, add in dividends, what you find is the typical rate of return is 2.6%. Now, 2.6% is only slightly better than what one will get in a usual low-risk, you know, savings bond or certificates of deposit. And I think that when you start to compare local businesses, they will look very competitive relative to this typical 2.6% return you get from Wall Street. And part of the problem right now is that we have to build out many pieces of the local investment ecosystem. And what I mean by that is that we have to make it easier for small businesses to issue securities so people can invest in them. We have to create local stock markets so that people can buy and sell these securities. We have to create pools of local capital, local investment funds, and we have to reinvent pension funds that then strategically invest in these local pools of capital. None of these things really exist right now, except for part one, which is beginning to make it easier for these small businesses to issue securities. So in the absence of local stock markets, in the absence of local investment funds, it is really hard today to argue that your local investments in other companies can be made as safe or as diversified as your investments in Wall Street. But I believe in the next 5 or 10 years, this really is going to change. And I think from the standpoint of your listeners, really our objective should be to move our money maybe at the rate of 1% per year from our conventional investing into local investing.
I think that's great advice. I believe that we should use your recommendation, become our own landlord, become our own utility, invest in our own potential. And that is the future. Small communities working together, pooling their resources, sharing in responsibilities. That's the free market machinery that they don't want to support on Wall Street. And I believe that that is one of the most important things we can do. Thank you very much for being on with us and sharing these insights. Michael Schumann, his website is cuttingedgecapital.com, his book, Local Dollars, Local Cents. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Now we only have 2 minutes. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, how about people become their own healthcare insurers? Yeah, when Obama's healthcare plan is his signature achievement, quote unquote, for his administration, and it's obviously he never realized that if he didn't ensure that it was going to work, it becomes a heap of junk. We have a lot of people from your audience who are emailing me, being concerned that by the end of March of 2014. If they don't have health care insurance, they're going to face a penalty. And I'm one of those people. Now, I'm not suggesting that people don't have health care insurance, but I'm suggesting that especially the people in your audience, we are our health care insurance. My daily habits, my attitudes about food and exercise and relaxation and managing stress, that is what's ensuring my health. And I don't want to have to dole out money to this Ponzi scheme. And, of course, everyone is in an uproar in the audience about what do we do about this?
I believe that what we should do is pull our resources together and find an insurance company out there that will cover alternative and complementary medicine, that does not charge large premiums, and that you get quality care, including catastrophic coverage. That's where most people don't pay attention. They don't equate their lifestyle, being overweight, being stressed, aging, maybe the poor diet they had earlier in their life with the consequences later in their life, because everything that you did earlier, you'll pay for later. You just don't know when. And there are a few, just a handful of companies that do offer that. But we have to make those nationally known. Then, as you suggested, we have to be diligent in trying to do all that's possible to be as healthy as we can be. And for those who are in this audience, I'd be willing to bet that compared with the average person of the same age, the same ethnicity, the same background, same educational standard, that this audience is way ahead of the curve as far as health. They're going to have normal blood pressure, not going to be diabetic, they're not going to be overweight, they're not going to have the same heart conditions. They won't have preconditions that are almost always inevitably going to cause disease. That's because of conscious choices they're making today. So there's nothing that you can do that will ensure that you're going to stay healthy in the future except the choices you make and have made. That's where we should be putting our energy. And there's no effort at a national level to do that. So what you and so many other people are doing, making healthy choices every day, that's the best insurance you can have. Then we should start looking for quality small companies willing to insure us, especially those who are living a healthier lifestyle to begin with, and give comprehensive insurance, including catastrophic insurance, in case someone has a catastrophic disease. That's all we can do at this moment.
Okay.
All the best. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. It's open forum, and that means, of course, people take the conversation where they want to, but we start the program today with an on-site report from Detroit, where the bankruptcy judge has basically created for Detroit a dubious distinction of being the largest municipality that has gone bankrupt. That decision just came up just not too long ago.
Are you going to be focusing on what the outcome of that will be for the residents of Detroit?
Oh, sure. Well, we'll do that tomorrow. Because we'll need to take a good look at what the judge's ruling, the actual wording of the ruling is. So we'll get a preliminary report today and go into greater depth tomorrow.
Good. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead right now.